I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, our conversation today about George H.W. Bush. A new book argues that despite his flaws, the first Bush was often a great president. But first, lawmakers on the Senate Intelligence Committee will grill CIA Director General Michael Hayden today. Hayden says he properly notified them about the destruction of videotapes showing two terrorism suspects being interrogated using waterboarding. But at least one House Democrat, Jane Harman, says she warned the CIA not to destroy the tapes and wasn't told when they were. And the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Jay Rockefeller, agrees. When the news about the interrogation videotapes broke last week, CIA Director Hayden claimed that Congress was notified in 2003 about the tapes' existence and the intent to destroy them. Well, also today, former CIA agent John Kiriakou is speaking out. He questioned one of the suspects in 2003. He didn't participate in the waterboarding, but told NBC's Today Show that he believes it is torture, that it provided valuable intelligence, and its use was approved at the highest levels of U.S. government. He said he now considers waterboarding unnecessary since terrorist groups have been infiltrated, and he's not sure what to think about the CIA destroying the tapes that recorded the method.
I want to think the best, but I think it was just a terrible mistake, at the very least for the historical record.
Well, joining us is Dan Egan, covering the story for The Washington Post. And Dan, first of all, what are the big questions that will be asked of Hayden today? What's in dispute?
The extent to which the Congress was told about the tapes and their destruction. CIA says that, he said in a very general way last week that Congress was basically fully informed and, implied that the appropriate lawmakers had been kept in the loop. But there's been a lot of dispute since then from lawmakers of both parties who say that while generally there seems to be acknowledgement that they were told of the existence of tapes, there's disagreement about whether, A, they were told that they would be destroyed, and, B, whether they were told after they were destroyed.
Right. Well, on Sunday you reported that in 2002, four members of Congress, including now House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, were briefed by the CIA. You go further to say that there were 30 different kinds of briefings. What has Pelosi said about what happened in that meeting? Did she learn that waterboarding was being used?
It has not been specific, no real specific response from, whether waterboarding itself was, just an acknowledgement that tough techniques were talked about. She did not lodge any objections at that time, although she says that she was, or it is, opposed to the use of waterboarding. So she's kind of walking a bit of a line there. Jane Harman, another member of Congress who took over her Pelosi spot on the Intelligence Committee the next year, did submit a written objection to waterboarding and other techniques. It was a classified letter, so it was not disclosed until just recently.
Right.
And so there's, there are a lot of varying responses from members of Congress.
Well, you also, in your reporting, quote a congressional source who says that Nancy Pelosi might have thought that what she was hearing was something that was in the planning stage, because there was a sort of a virtual tour of centers, and she might have thought that this wasn't actually happening.
Right, right. That's a good point, that she makes the distinction between thinking that she was being told about things they were planning to do rather than things that they were actually doing. However, by the time she was being briefed in September of 2002, the Justice Department had issued the now infamous document known as the torture memo, which essentially gave the CIA carte blanche to go forward with these techniques, and by all indications, they had begun going forward with them. And intelligence officials say they were told about that.
Well, now former CIA agent John Kiriakou is talking. You spoke with him. How does what he has to say contribute to this story?
Well, it's first of all, it's very rare to have an intelligence officer on the record publicly identified.
Well, we wanted to ask you about that. Why do you think he's coming forward now? Presumably he has CIA clearance to speak, but one of the CIA Director Hayden's rationales for destroying the tapes was that there would be retaliation against agents. So why do you think he's speaking now?
Well, it's not entirely clear. He seems to be, he's also of a mixed mind as to, his views on waterboarding. He says on the one hand that he believes it led to information that helped save lives and stave off attacks, but also in hindsight thinks it was torture and that we shouldn't do it again. So he's, in some ways, he reflects the ambiguity that a lot of people feel about this issue. But as to why he's decided to come forward now, that is not entirely clear.
I was going to ask how you thought his words might cut because, you know, he goes on to say further that it, within 35 seconds, information was gathered from this one suspect who was undergoing waterboarding, this drowning technique, and yet he says there'd be no need for it now because now he feels that there are agents in the field. So which way will his words cut?
Based on the reactions I've seen, they seem to cut both ways.
Right.
Each side gets a little piece for their argument because he unequivocally says, I believe this is torture. But he also essentially defends its use, at least at that time, as necessary. And then there's, of course, so much more that we need to know about how much the information that prisoner actually gave. There have been many reports in the past that, in fact, a lot of the information
was
given
false.
By that prisoner was really nonsense.
Well, Dan Agin, we have the questioning today, several investigations. Where do you think this is going to go, briefly?
It's going to go in all kinds of directions. You've got a possible, at least a preliminary criminal inquiry going on at the Justice Department and CIA Inspector General's office. And that's going to be the main line of inquiry is going to be whether there was a crime committed in the destruction of these videotapes. But it also seems clear that we're going to also find out even more about the use of these techniques after the September 11 attacks.
Dan Agin, Justice Department reporter for The Washington Post. Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, historically, when the CIA tries to investigate itself, there are pitfalls. In 1976, George H.W. Bush, father of the current president, was head of the CIA. In a new biography, historian Tim Naftali writes of how Bush formed a special civilian unit to investigate the true threat of the Soviet Union. The CIA had been accused of being surprised by Soviet missile tests. So Bush formed this unit called Team B, and we asked him to tell us about Team B.
In the 1970s, people who later became known as neocons believed that the Nixon-Kissinger approach to the Soviet Union was all wrong.
Which is détente.
Which was to negotiate arms control agreements. Their argument was the Soviet Union is cheating and, in fact, is developing a first strike capability. They're going to be able to destroy us because we're hoping for peace and they're hoping for victory. People are saying the CIA is soft-pedaling the Soviet threat. And the CIA decides to do something unprecedented, which is to let these outside critics get information and write their own estimate. The interesting thing is that the Team B assessment of the Soviet Union was completely wrong. Totally exaggerated Soviet power. Soviet Union was an economic basket case and couldn't, because of its economic weakness, really compete with us strategically. George Bush witnessed this, understood it, and yet, when Ronald Reagan was president, he was ineffectual at trying to move that administration to a more reality-based understanding of the Soviet threat because all the evidence points to his not believing this exaggerated view of what Moscow wanted to do.
And yet, to remind us, Ronald Reagan took that distorted image of the Soviet Union and used it to, you know, escalate an arms race and a war of words with the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. Until he has an epiphany in this moment when he meets Gorbachev and realizes there was a way to do business with Gorbachev. That was a big turning point for Ronald Reagan, and that happens in about 1986. So for the last 2 and a bit years of the Reagan administration, the United States government has a completely different view of the Soviet Union. But ironically, George Bush is one of those who doubts the closeness between Washington and Moscow, and it's going to take him 9 months as president to realize that Ronald Reagan was actually right about Gorbachev. There are a number of messes that the Reagan administration left that Bush cleaned up. He cleaned up the savings and loan crisis at home with the help of Congress. He cleaned up the budget issue. Bush did a number of very good things. One of the things he didn't quite do very well when he came into office was he didn't embrace Reagan's policy towards Gorby. But when things started to change in Poland, that was a signal to Bush, yes, indeed, Gorby's willing to let Eastern Europe go, and if he's willing to do that, he's a real deal.
Historian Tim Naftali. So George H.W. Bush was praised for letting outsiders into the CIA, but he didn't say more about their conclusions, which he disagreed with and which shaped Reagan policy. How will history reflect on George H.W. Bush? That's the core of our conversation with Tim Naftali, whose biography of George H.W. Bush is the latest in the American President series. Tim is also director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum. We'll pick up our conversation with him at the end of the Cold War. Bush had been Reagan's vice president, was the sitting president when the Berlin Wall fell. He was also the son of a wealthy senator, a heroic World War II fighter pilot, a congressman, an oilman, U.S. rep to the UN, and liaison to China.
He was a man who was better prepared to be president than perhaps any other man in our history. But no one knew in 1988 what he would do with the office. And I think that was the surprise for me, that actually he used the power quite reasonably. He was a much better president than he was a candidate. As a candidate, Bush flip-flopped. He often presented himself as being more conservative than he was.
It was the whole garbled syntax thing.
Here is a patrician who has in the back of his mind his mother's admonitions not to use I, not to take credit. So you'll find when Bush would speak, he would rarely use the personal pronoun I, and he would speak in the passive voice. It was as if he did not want to say, I will do this, I have done this. It was difficult to understand and ultimately seemed deceptive. Well, it wasn't, but it was just his way.
It was sort of the WASP upbringing where you, and what, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, where you just, we don't do
well,
that.
Well, you know, I mean, his mother had this term, when you show off, you're doing the la-di-das. And when Bush was doing well in the early primaries in 1980 against Ronald Reagan, he told the press, I've got the big mo. It was that plus these other fractured, awkward phrases that led people to wonder, well, is this man capable of the commanding rhetoric we expect from our presidents? We think a great president has to be a great rhetorician. Well, Bush certainly wasn't. Bush couldn't really explain what he was doing. Yet, we also have to be considerate of the decisions he makes. And when push came to shove, in the light of history, George H.W. Bush did the right thing.
Well, let's talk about just a few of the things that he did in light of what you've been saying, you know, his mother's admonitions, for instance. When the wall did come down, the Berlin Wall, his advisors wanted him to go and have the photo op on top. And when you think about it, it's unimaginable that any other American president wouldn't do that.
Somebody said, why don't you dance on the Berlin Wall? He did the same thing John F. Kennedy did after the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy's advisors wanted Kennedy to puff out his chest and say, I beat Nikita Khrushchev. We were eyeball to eyeball, and he blinked. Kennedy said, you don't do that with the Russians. Don't make it harder for them to retreat. George H.W. Bush did the same thing. The last thing he wanted to do was make it harder for Gorbachev to let East Germany and Eastern Europe go free. It made him look, again, incapable of those grand theatrical moves that Ronald Reagan did so naturally. But you know what? In the final analysis, it was the right thing to do.
That's historian Tim Naftali, author of George H.W. Bush. It's the latest biography in the American Presidents series. We'll have more when we come back, including Bush the Senior's role in the Iran-Contra scandal. And later in the program, doctors for humans and veterinarians get together to share information about zoonotic diseases, diseases that pass from pets to their owners. They say people worry so much about, for instance, cleaning out that litter box, they should be more concerned about working in the garden. Where does the neighborhood cat go? That's later. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with our conversation with Tim Naftali, author of George H.W. Bush. It's the latest volume in the American Presidents series. Before the break, Tim was talking about how adeptly George H.W. Bush handled the end of the Cold War when he was president. But what about Iran-Contra? This was the Reagan administration's secret deal to sell arms to Iranians in exchange for hostages who were being held by Hezbollah in Lebanon, diverting the profits from those arms sales to the rebel Contras, who were fighting the leftist Sandinista government in Nicaragua. This allowed the Reagan administration to end-run Congress and support the Contras. Bush was vice president at the time. I asked Tim Naftali to explain Bush's role in that scandal.
This was not Bush's shining moment as a foreign policy advisor. And the worst part of the story is that he was so ambitious. He wanted to be president so much that he tried to cover his role in advising Reagan. He didn't allow, for example, the independent counsel to see his diaries until the month after he was defeated for a second term. George Bush was tried very hard to cover his tracks in the Iran-Contra story. There's no evidence that he was involved in the diversion, the illegal diversion of funds from the sale of the missiles to Tehran to the Contras fighting the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. There's no evidence of that, but there's quite a bit of evidence that he was involved in the foreign policy folly regarding the initiative in Tehran. He very much tried to hide that, conceal it from the American public. And in some of his public statements during the campaign of 88, well, he was downright deceptive.
Well, if that was one of the darkest moments of the George H.W. Bush presidency and career, what were some of the brightest? I mean, you mentioned his handling of the Cold War. Obviously, he also waged the first Gulf War after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. He made the pledge early on when he was running, read my lips, no new taxes, and then broke that pledge later. What would you pick as the great moments?
2 weeks after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, the United Nations had already passed a resolution calling on Iraq to leave Kuwait. But the resolution had no teeth in it. The United States had established a naval blockade of Iraq. And Washington gets news that five oil tankers are steaming towards Yemen. And there's a debate among Bush's advisors. Do you enforce the naval blockade? Do you stop these tankers? And initially, Bush is somewhat persuaded. But James Baker says to Bush, we really could get a United Nations resolution with teeth in it. But that would mean the Soviets allying with us. And there's no way the Soviets are going to go with us if we enforce the blockade now. So he decided, let the tankers get to Yemen, but let's go to the Soviets and say, you see the problem here? Will you work with us at the United Nations to get a resolution that has teeth and will allow us to enforce, if necessary, with military means, the blockade? Now, this is the point when Margaret Thatcher said, now, don't go wobbly, George. Mm-hmm. And there were others who were saying to Bush, no, 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 don't wait for the United Nations. Enforce the blockade with the United States Navy. Well, he didn't. And the Soviets were given their week, and the Soviets agreed, and we got a much better resolution, and it became the world against Saddam Hussein, not just the United States. That was statesmanship. That was tough, and this was an issue for George Bush. George Bush hated the idea that some people thought he was a wimp. This was a man who had enormous physical courage. He flew 58 bombing missions over hostile territory in the Pacific in World War II. He had seen two of his crewmates die when his plane was hit by Japanese anti-aircraft fire, and he flew eight more missions afterwards. Nevertheless, he didn't always have political courage. He flip-flopped on certain very important issues. In 1964, he was against Lyndon Johnson's Civil Rights Act. In 1968, however, as a congressman, he supported it. He was pro-choice in that era. That was the George Bush of the 1960s. Well, if we, you remember him from the 1980 campaign when he flip-flops from being pro-choice to being anti-abortion once he joins with Reagan, you recognize that this is a man whose views seemed in flux on some of the important domestic issues of the day.
How will history look on George H.W. Bush's decision not to pursue Saddam Hussein from Kuwait back to Baghdad?
Oh, it'll look very favorably on that decision. The same issues that we see today were discussed by George H.W. Bush and his advisors, and they all agreed it made no sense for the United States to be in the state creation business in Iraq. History will look very, very well on that decision.
Well, given that, how would you characterize George H.W.'s views of his son's presidency? I mean, you have glimpses of it.
You know, I'm sure it's a complicated story. I'm sure that George H.W. Bush was disappointed that the United States went to war against Iraq without a real international coalition, not just the coalition of the willing, but a broad-based coalition as he had enjoyed in 1990 and 91. I'm sure he was disappointed that the country was and is divided about this decision. But I don't doubt that somewhere inside, George H.W. Bush is delighted that his nemesis, Saddam Hussein, is no more. And for that, I guess he can thank his son. George H.W. Bush and George Bush faced and face some of the same issues and dealt with them differently. It's an amazing contrast, and it really is unprecedented in American history. You can't do that for John Adams and John Quincy Adams. Their eras were so different. The questions they faced were so novel for each one. I finished the book saying that just as George H.W. Bush had to come on the scene to clean up some of Ronald Reagan's messes, in a sense, we need someone like him to clean up, ironically, his son's messes.
Tim Naftali is an historian and author of George H.W. Bush. It's the latest volume in the American Presidents series. He's also director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum. He's been speaking to us from the studios of NPR West. Tim, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
Okay, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll visit a young soldier at a private hospital, Spalding Rehab, here in Boston. His family felt he'd get better care outside of the VA system. Well, the rehabilitation of Private Vincent Mannion might set a precedent for other troops with traumatic brain injuries. That story's tomorrow. Still to come today, imagining outer space. Back after the news, Here and Now. What do the following things have in common? Roundworm, cat scratch fever, scabies. Well, all of them are in some way contracted from pets, which is why veterinarians and doctors are beginning to work together. They recently gathered in Rhode Island for one of the nation's largest conferences on the topic. We spoke to veterinarian Michael Lappin, a professor of small animal internal medicine at Colorado State University, and Byron Blagburn, an infectious disease specialist at Auburn University in Alabama. And I began by asking Dr. Blagburn to tell us what to call these diseases that pass from animals to humans.
Well, the term we use, Robin, is zoonosis, and zoonosis is a term that was coined many, many years ago for any agent that can be potentially transmitted from animals to humans. There are different ways that humans contract diseases from animals. Some contract them directly from animals by being in contact with animals. Others are contracted by being exposed to the animal's environment, and still others are contracted by being exposed to insect and acarine, those are ticks and mites, that have fed previously on an infected animal.
Well, in some way we feel we're familiar with, but I feel that there's more to learn. For instance, roundworm. I had no idea it was so common that vets see it on a daily basis. Tell us how roundworm can be spread to humans.
You're exactly right, Robin. Roundworm is a very, 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 very common parasite of young dogs. We even see it in older dogs. And what these dogs do is they shed eggs into their environments. And those environments can be the home, it can be the park, it can be other recreation sites such as the beach.
And this is, you know, it's rather indelicate, but it's through their feces.
It is, it is. And those eggs then go ahead and in the environment become infective. And then humans, particularly small children, are exposed to soil containing the eggs. And once ingested, those eggs have a little worm inside them that then begins its migration through the human body. There are documented cases of very, very severe, what we call visceral disease, which are referenced to the organs in the abdominal cavity, occasionally find their way to the eye. And if that a particular site of inflammation in the eye is near the area of acute vision, it can be so severe that the eye has to be removed.
And we know the American Medical Association resolution passed in May of this year resolved that the AMA and the American Veterinary Association would discuss strategies for enhancing collaboration between the medical and veterinary professions in medical education, clinical care, public health, and biomedical research. So boil that down for us. We start with you, Dr. Lappin. You know, what kind of exchanges can you have that can do just that?
As veterinarians, the animals can occasionally be sentinels for the development of a new disease or a new disease in a region, like Lyme disease, for example, and it can be very beneficial for us to interact. It's also very important, I believe, for the family members to interact with both their physician and their veterinarian for making a health plan for their animal and their public health plan for the animal and their owners.
Well, you know, Robin, if I might just add to that, we don't want to discourage the adoption and maintenance of pets because pets provide immeasurable joy, but we do want to do what we can to to create dialogue between the two professions, the two disciplines that will reduce the likelihood of transmission.
Well, and in doing some reading, we see that, you know, having a pet can lower your blood pressure so they can be healthy for you. Dr. Blackburn, while we were preparing to do this talk, you were asking Dr. Lappin, the veterinarian, some questions that you had. It seemed, I think it was about cat scratches. What would you, as a human doctor, want to ask a vet?
We were talking about cat scratch disease, and the way humans acquire it is by flea feces or circulates in the blood of the cat, and when fleas feed on them, fleas tend to defecate in the hair coat, and when a cat scratches, it sort of acquires that blood deposited in the hair coat temporarily under the claws, and of course, when they get angry and scratch a person, they deposit part of that blood in those bacteria. And that's the way humans get infected. That's why it's called cat scratch disease. Now, I was asking Dr. Lappin, if a small child actually ingested a flea, does that happen or can that happen?
Right. We certainly know cats ingest a lot of Bartonella because the cats are very agile and fast, and they swallow fleas like crazy. And, of course, during their grooming habits, they will also ingest the live Bartonella that's in the flea feces, which we call lovingly flea dirt. I don't know a documented transmission by that mechanism to humans, but it certainly is plausible, especially with the kids that are more likely to ingest things like that.
Well, Dr. Blackburn, I want to ask you, what's the first thing you would want people to know? We have pets. We sleep with them on our beds. You know, we kiss them on the nose. Tell us a couple of things you think people should know.
Certainly visit your veterinarian. Where your pet relieves itself outdoors, I think keep those areas clean. Remove feces. Be cautious, particularly when you have young animals, young children, when you go to parks and other sites, because not all parasites are controlled in all pets. Make attempts to control fleas, ticks, mosquitoes, which of course are our principal three in the transmission of disease. And remember that those are seasonal, and our efforts have to be intensified at certain times of the season.
What about the spread of viruses, you know, which aren't parasites? How do we protect against that?
Most of the viruses that are shared between animals and man are actually transmitted by insects or mosquitoes. So the direct contact zoonotic agent that we're most worried about in North America and other parts of the world is actually rabies. And mm-hmm. So avoiding bites and scratches from animals that you're not familiar with or with unknown vaccination history is very important.
We're reminded 50,000 people die every year around the world from rabies. So it's no small thing. And you know, rabies is, you know, horrendous and fatal, but we're reminded as well that cat bites can be infected. But Dr. Lappin, I just want to ask you one other thing when it comes to cats. There's the thinking, and I'm not sure if it's myth, that if a woman is pregnant, she shouldn't be around cat litter. Is that true?
Well, the organism that's being discussed when we're worried about older cat feces, that might be in the litter box for greater than a day, is the organism Toxoplasma gondii. The unborn fetus is a classic susceptible host, and so if a mother has her first exposure to Toxoplasma gondii during the pregnancy period, there could be some dire consequences. The good news is cats only shed for a very short period of time.
And Robin, this is Dr. Blackburn again. In this country, we have actually found that our principal source of toxoplasma is probably pork. And so what we want to do is make sure that pork is cooked completely adequately. And also, when preparing food, make sure that carving boards and instruments that you use to cut meat are cleaned well. And going back to this stage that cats shed in feces, remember that it's not so much the individual house pet is shedding the organism so much. It might be the neighbor's cat or cats that are running around, and they use the garden.
Boy, in doing some reading, I am reminded I'm wearing my gloves when I garden.
Excellent. And watch that produce very well.
Yeah, that, and if we do that, the risk of cats and the risk of food to women and their children, really, it's very, very small.
Well, it's been fascinating speaking to both of you. That's Dr. Byron Blackburn. He's a parasitologist at Auburn University in Alabama. We also spoke to Dr. Michael Lappin. He's a vet. He's a professor of small animal internal medicine at Colorado State University. And we thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
And when I snuggle with my kitty under the covers tonight, I'm going to look at her in a whole different way. Very important information. By the way, if you can go to our website, you might want to go now, here-now.org. In about 5 minutes, we're going to have our tour of space, and the pictures are already posted. They're just beautiful. So you might want to get ahead of the game. You're listening to Here and Now. Pennsylvania's Valley Forge, when there's a bit of a mist and herds of white-tailed deer grazing, is one of my favorite driving experiences, probably because I've never hit one of those deer. Pennsylvania is first in the country for car deer collisions, 98,000 a year, according to the Insurance Institute. And State Farm Insurance Company estimates that 1.5 million vehicles collide with deer every year nationwide, killing 150 motorists and an unknown number of deer. And the worst time for those collisions, right now, when deer are chasing after prospective mates. Well, joining us from State Farm in Bloomington, Illinois, is spokesperson Dick Ludke. He's compiled a list of states. And Dick, if Pennsylvania has the most accidents, we understand that in West Virginia, you're more likely to have an accident.
Yeah, we threw a little bit of a new twist into our list this year, Robin. We wanted to measure the frequency of collisions, that is, the likelihood that you're going to collide with a deer over the next year, the next 12 months. And it turns out that West Virginia is the place where that's most likely to happen, even though there are more deer-vehicle collisions in Pennsylvania. Of course, there are many more vehicles in Pennsylvania
right.
than there are in West Virginia.
In West Virginia, your chances are 1 in 57. What are some of the other states where, you know, this is such a danger?
On the frequency list, Michigan is number 2. The likelihood of one vehicle striking a deer there over the next 12 months is 1 in 86. Wisconsin is 3rd, and Iowa rounds out the top 5.
Well, and my best friend Beverly hit a deer in Sudbury, Massachusetts, so it can happen anywhere, and it's very traumatic. What do you recommend that people do when you literally see a deer in your headlights? My first thought would be to try to save the deer.
Well, of course, your instinct is to try to avoid the collision, but to swerve out of the way of the deer and then hit another car, of course, could be even more traumatic than hitting the deer.
Do I actually understand statistically that that's when the worst accidents happen, when people swerve?
Exactly. Hmm. You lose control of your car, and then who knows what might happen.
We understand that deer are most active when we are, at dawn and dusk, and as we said, this time of year when they're mating and not paying attention to you, they're chasing after each other, sometimes for miles at a time. What does State Farm think of those deer whistles, which, we've heard in some states, drivers have been required to put them on their car because they've hit so many deer, but do they work?
Well, whether the deer hear the whistle or not, the studies show that the whistles do not change the deer's behavior. And so I don't think that you should bank on the fact that you're going to get extra protection from a deer whistle.
Dick Ludke, spokesperson for State Farm in Bloomington, Illinois. We'll just be careful out on the roads. Dick, thank you.
Good to talk to you, Robin.
Joining us now, Donnie Whitaker. He does damage estimates at Elite Auto in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, one of the high-risk states for auto deer collisions. And Donnie, we understand you're pretty busy this time of year.
Yes, ma'am, we sure are.
And you have one customer in particular. Steve, is it Clevenger?
Yes, ma'am, that's correct.
Tell us about his interactions with deer.
Well, Steve sort of much has an attraction for deer, it seems like. We've repaired his Toyota truck, I think it's about 6 or 7 times due to deer hits.
You gave him a plaque and a $150 gift certificate because of the business that he brought you.
Yes, ma'am.
Is there something about the way he drives or where he drives? Or?
It's got to do more with where a person lives. Society's just building up in the rural areas. And the deer, where they're at, they have nowhere else to go, and they're becoming more accustomed to it.
Well, in fact, that's backed up by statistics that it's not as if the deer population is really exploding. It's more that building is encroaching on
exactly.
their land. Well, and we want to mention one last thought for the poor deer. They say that if you hit one and it's still alive, call the police and call wildlife services, because you're not to go near a deer that's been injured, because they can develop something called capture myopathy,
mm-hmm.
in which the body releases toxins into the muscles, and this response can, maybe damage the liver and kill them when the hit didn't. So
right.
don't go near the injured deer.
Exactly. And we had a gentleman come in here. We were doing the estimate on his vehicle, and we were talking, and he's a runner also. And he was saying, it's amazing when he's running. He said, you may see a couple on the side of the road when you're riding down the road, he said, but when I'm running, I see more in the woods to where, they'll get hit and run out, and then, back mm-hmm. in the woods, they'll die back there.
Well, Donnie Whitaker at Elite Auto Body in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And coming up, we'll look up a tour of outer space with a noted stargazer as our guide. Back in a minute, here and now. The spacecraft Voyager 2 is far, far from home at the edge of the solar system, and it's sent back data to NASA confirming what scientists had suspected, that the magnetic bubble enveloping the solar system has a squashed shape. Voyager 1 and 2 were launched back in 1977. Voyager 1 passed through the edge of the solar system in 2004, but didn't have the instruments on board to make the same measurements Voyager 2 did. Both spacecraft will reach the end of the solar system in about a decade. From there, it's on to interstellar space. Well, back here on Earth, David Aguilar spends a lot of time imagining what those far-flung parts of the solar system look like. He's director of the science information at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He's also the author of a new encyclopedia of the universe from National Geographic. It's called Planets, Stars, and Galaxies. It's for young and not so young readers. He's an artist, and with a computer and a mouse, he illustrated the book. So, David, tell us first, these images of space in this book are fantastic. Are they real or imagined?
Yes, they are.
Both.
They're both.
That's right.
They are images that are the best we can possibly do. The scientific data is correct. We know this is what some of these things look like. It's just that we're mortal humans and we may never go there ourselves. So this is the next best thing.
Well, these images are extraordinary, by the way. Go to our website, here-now.org. Right now, if you can, and you can follow along. Let's talk about them. We've got these beautiful images in the book, but also around us in the studio where we are. I want to go to page 53, the section on Saturn. There's sort of this landmass that appears in the foreground and then beautiful Saturn beyond that. What's that landmass?
That landmass is one of Saturn's moons, Mimas. And what we're looking at is a huge crater that gave this small little moon a big black eye. And it's as if you're just hovering above that crater, looking at Saturn off in the distance.
You say Saturn, the most beautiful planet. Why is it the most beautiful to you?
It's the rings. And what's amazing for me is when I take people outdoors and show them Saturn through a telescope, it stops them. And they look at it and they say, it's real. The rings are real, as if we've been fooling them all these years with the photographs. To see Saturn through a telescope is stunning, and that's why I think it's the most beautiful planet, maybe besides the Earth in our solar system.
Well, then there's Jupiter. Oh, my gosh. Now, in the Jupiter illustration, you have this sort of landmass in the foreground that is ice, and you've got two astronauts, it appears, with power packs on their backs. They're made tiny, by the huge Jupiter that's in the background with its moons. So how do you know that that's what it looks like?
We've taken photographs of Europa, which is the moon that we're looking at there, and we know what the surface would look like. I've just decided this is what it would look like if you were standing on it. Now imagine Jupiter. Jupiter's huge. It's the biggest planet in the solar system. You could put every other planet in our solar system inside of it. And yet here it has this moon that is covered with ice, but it may have oceans that are 60 miles deep. This is an ocean world, just simply frozen on the outside, but who knows what's swimming in those oceans.
And Jupiter, as we look at it from that moon, as you say, we can only see, no matter what instruments we use, we only see the tops of its clouds. So it's got this very swirly sort of, how would you describe the
those are bands. We call them bands, and they're being whipped along by winds that can hit 250, 300 miles an hour. This is a planet you couldn't walk on. Jupiter is like a big slushy snow cone in outer space.
You write about dark matter in the book. This is one of the many mysteries of space. We know dark matter is there because it has gravity. It's pulling on the stuff that we can see, but we can't see the dark matter yet. So you illustrate dark matter with a door. Tell us why you did that.
It's a doorway that opens up to an entirely different part of our universe. It's a mystery part of our universe. Imagine that right now the dilemma astrophysicists have when they realize 95% of our universe is missing. We don't know what it is. We can't see it. We can't taste it, feel it, touch it, but we know it's there. So this doorway symbolizes that tomorrow, next year, 50 years from now, somebody is going to unlock that door and open it up and let us know what dark matter and dark energy is and what 95% the rest of our universe is made of.
It looks like, an album cover from the 60s, sort of expanding your mind. There's a door floating in space there. A lot of the illustrations have this sort of, how you imagine something. For instance, over here to my right, there are these floating I don't know, they look like little electronic insects with cocktail umbrellas on top of them floating around a planet. What is that?
I've never heard it described that way before. Those are solar sails, and this is a marvelous concept for getting around in our solar system. You just make a gigantic sail, a mile or two in diameter, out of mylar, hook it up to your spaceship. The solar winds blowing on it will inflate it, and you'll sail between the planets, just like sailboats in the ocean sail.
That's beautiful. Next to that is another imagined, but you say, you know, maybe on the drawing board somewhere, another imagined rocket ship made out of what?
That's an asteroid. This is a great concept that's been around for quite a while. Instead of building your spaceship in outer space, hauling all that material up there and putting it together, go grab a good-sized asteroid, hollow it out, slap an engine on the back of it, light it up with a life support system, and off you go.
That one looks like a baked potato in space. I mean, they're just fantastic. You know, when I hear you speak about these things, I get a lot more excited about them than I remembered, you know, getting in third grade or fourth grade. We shouldn't really have to go out of our way to make the fantastic, phantasmagoric. But that's what it feels like, that you know, part of this is that you want people to say, hey, look, you know, look at this.
Robin, astronomy today is we're learning more every day than we ever imagined possible. And consequently, the discoveries that are coming across scientific desks are stunning. And it's just the beginning. The audacity of these creatures on this small little planet around a diminutive star out in the arms of the Milky Way galaxy to begin contemplating where the universe came from, where the universe is going, and come up with the answers. That's us. Defines who we are as a species. And this book, to me, started when I was a child, and I made telescopes, and I went to science fiction movies and read books about science fiction and the future and planets and the solar systems. It's a part of me in here that still to this moment cannot imagine how exciting things could get, and then they do. I'm always taken back by the discoveries that are being made. And some people say, you know what, astronomy, why bother? It won't make you richer. It won't make you happier. It makes you wiser. It places you in the magnificence of this universe. It shows you your spot. And to realize that we are unraveling gigantic mysteries. How did the universe begin? How will the universe end? What creature has the audacity to ask these questions and find the answers? Us.
That is David Aguilar. He's Director of Science Information at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, also the writer and illustrator of a new Encyclopedia of the Universe from National Geographic. It's called Planets, Stars, and Galaxies. It is phantasmagoric. David, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Robin, really my pleasure.